This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th, and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, the sleight of hand artist, radio commentator, actor, and author Ricky Jay is back with us. His newest book is Extraordinary Exhibitions, The Wonderful Remains of Enormous Head, The Wimpiskashun, and Death to the Savage Unitarians by Ricky Jay. Ricky, thanks for being here. Did I get that part of the title right?
You don't think you did you? No. The Whims of Fusakan.
Of course. That's what I meant to say. I was sneezing. But the book is Extraordinary Exhibitions, and I'm going to read a little bit from the introduction. Snowbills are the black sheep of theatrical memorabilia. They have never enjoyed the respectability of souvenir prints or programs, let alone the form of big museum shows devoted to their favorite sibling, the full-color lithographic poster. But posters have attracted critical attention relatively recently, and it's possible that ephemeral bills like the one shown here will soon bask in the limelight. That is of little concern to me.
Well, I have to say that that's true, that I didn't begin collecting these broadsides and playbills because I thought they would be of great value. I began to collect them because I found them irresistible, and they're irresistible for a number of reasons. They're irresistible for me because of the language, which is often orotund and rococo and filled with rhodomontade and just truly wonderful.
The authors on these handbills are so in love with language. And that's obviously one of the things that attracted you to these things.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. The two areas I've always collected passionately, books as well as ephemera like this, has been the area of unusual entertainments and the area of deception. And they often come together in these pieces.
Yes. The mermaid handbill, which we have right here in front of you. If you
could good example. Yeah, I show a broadside of a mermaid from 1789 with this rather fascinating woodcut of this creature dragged from the sea near some island that, of course, we've never heard of in the Gulf of Stanchio. And the thing that I say in the text, though, is if you're ever looking at the broadside of a mermaid, you're looking at a hoax. I mean, clearly, there used to be an actual trade in the making of mermaids. They were artfully constructed from a number of creatures, usually a monkey and a fish. And there was absolutely at one point a Japanese cottage industry which was involved in the making of mermaids, which they would sell to unsuspecting folks.
I guess I wonder when I sort of see this stuff, for me, there's a kind of a magic in language that sort of lends itself to stage presentation, which I think must have attracted you on some level too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, you know, I know that you have seen the shows that I do on stage, and I'm very fond of using language that's also ornate. I mean, I'd have to say clearly these bills have affected my writing and my stage performance. But I think maybe you're reaching at something slightly more subtle than that, which is the use of language perhaps to even misdirect, to get somebody so involved in the telling of a tale that they'd be less likely to concentrate on your hands at a particular moment, or that you're able to focus their attention on a given point by the use of language as well as physical movement.
Because so much of the language here reminds me of the stuff many of us have seen in movies of the carnival barker, the fast talker whose lips are basically as deft as most sleight of hand artists' hands.
Well, again, yes, and also I did work for a portion of my life as the outside talker for a Carnival 10 in one show.
I was trying to lead you to that.
Yeah.
So,
the combination of – I guess I suppose as I'm getting older, I realize that my passions are pretty much the same. You know, if someone suddenly gave me $50 million and said, get a hobby, you have no pressure in life to do anything but get a hobby, I would choose the same things that have interested me for years. I still truly love them. I mean, just going away, I've been off performing doing one of my one-man shows in Washington for a month and a half and coming home and seeing a number of these broadsides which have just been returned from a museum in the house. In other words, they just arrived. I left for 5 or 6 weeks and now I've come home and I'm seeing them again and I'm just excited. I mean, I'm literally happy to see these pieces. It's like being reacquainted with old friends. It's the passion is real.
My guest is Ricky Jay. You, of course, know him as an actor from movies of Paul Thomas Anderson, such as Boogie Nights and Magnolia, and his work with David Mamet. He's also an amazing author. This book of extraordinary exhibitions is called Extraordinary Exhibitions. If you would, define for the audience what a broadside is, because you start with broadside and handbill and daybill. You explain what all these things
right.
are.
Right. A broadside is basically a printed piece that appears on one side of a page, a broadside. And I deal in this book with broadsides, which I've managed to acquire from the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And I say at one point they're almost like the equivalent of today's Thai menus. They were handed out in the earliest forms to passersby. Then they were pasted up on walls. Eventually, by the 19th century, there were enormous blocks of wood on which posters were placed on a regular basis. They were usually called stands. And these broadsides were slapped on stands with wheat paste. And one of the things that I find wonderful about this tradition is that it still exists. There are friends of mine who are bill posters, and it's actually very big in the rap community as well. There's a fellow that I met recently who gained his rep by doing 10,000 bills of one rap artist in a month. I mean, there's still people who put these pieces on walls. There are legal sites. There are legal sites, and it's a lovely art form. And I start the book with an excerpt from Charles Dickens, describing a 19th century British house, and this is not a fictional piece. It was a piece when he edited Household Words, that literally was crumbling over the weight of hundreds and thousands of broadsides slapped on its walls for so long that it could barely stand.
It's a wonderful image, but that's the thing about we don't almost in some ways just the language and a number of these broadsides here don't have pictures on them. There's just language in them.
Absolutely.
And they work in that way, just sort of conjuring without any kind of a sort of artist rendering it all anyway, don't they?
Right, and sometimes words like Whims of Fusicon, which I mentioned on the front cover as sort of a joke because it's a neologism. These showmen used words that were created for the moment. I can't actually tell you what a Whims of Fusicon was or what the divine art of rhabdomancy did or what a skiaterion was. And these are all words that you find in these bills, often bills of musicians and magicians. The Whims of Fusicon was unquestionably a musical instrument, but beyond that, I have a feeling it might have been one of those one-string gut-like instruments that you plucked, but I don't absolutely know. These were just things that were put on the bills to try to attract people to come into the shows. In an era pre-television and pre-radio, you had to excite people with language or with image. And the earliest ones of these have just language and eventually image. And the other thing it makes me question, too, is how literate was the populace to whom these things were being handed? Certainly a fair part of the population, particularly in the 17th and 18th century, were illiterate.
Well, that's the thing, too. And there, as you sort of note, it's easy to see in the book, there's so many sort of pretenses at education or so many sort of faux doctors. So there's this sort of thing, it almost seems like a connection to aristocracy by this kind of language. And
well, sometimes these were humanizing. Sometimes the idea of a show that could be enjoyed by a number of classes of people was very important. I mean, one of the pieces I love in this book is Queen Victoria giving her imprimatur on a chicken incubating machine. And it turned out she was almost a groupie of unusual entertainment. She loved Tom Thumb. She liked all sorts of physical anomalies and freaks. But I just love the idea of a chicken incubating machine under the patronage of Her Royal Majesty.
Well, you also talked in the introduction about, I guess it was a handbill that she was given that was on satin.
Actually, that was the Queen of the Sandwich Islands, which is even more bizarre. The Queen of the Sandwich Islands, this is earlier, this is an 18th century bill, is being feted for her appearance in London. And her appearance is not to be exhibited, but to meet and greet the people of the city of London. And so she's invited to a production of the theater. And she's given a playbill of the theatrical event, which is printed on silk. And that was often done for important or royal occasions. And this playbill is handed to her, and she has no idea what it's for. So she uses it to wipe her nose and then drops it, and there's a mad scurry. I love the idea of 18th century collectors vying for this piece of royal ephemera.
If only they had an eBay. My guest is Ricky Jay. His book of handbills, playbills, And Broadside, it's amazing pieces of work. It's called Extraordinary Exhibitions. There's one thing you mentioned here in the book that makes me laugh every time I see it, and I've got to read this aloud. The broadside for a pig-faced lady of 1815 was obviously a hoax, but clean-shaven bears done in gloves, gowns, and hats were passed off as pig-faced humans to a credulous fair-going public later in the century.
It's a sad tale. I'm sure animal lovers like myself are not going to be keen on what actually happened. But the story of the pig-faced lady goes back to the 17th century, the idea that a woman of absolutely enormous wealth, an heir to an extraordinary fortune, except that she looked and smelled like a pig, is seeking suitors, and ads would appear in papers. And they happen in the 17th century, in the 18th century, in the 19th century. Well, eventually by the 19th century, showmen figured that it would be nice to be able to exhibit such a creature. And since there was no pig-faced lady, they actually managed to take a bear and shave its face and paws and put a bonnet on it. And then here's the part that's cruel but also rather extraordinary. They would hire a child to sit under a draped table, and whenever the pig, the bear, was asked a question, the child would prod the pig with a stick, and it would manage to grunt out something, which the showman would then interpret as the answer to the question that was being asked. But
there's kind of an amusing anecdote related in the section about the pig-faced woman, in which I guess the dwarf who worked with the pig-faced woman apparently figured out that she was in fact a bear.
Yeah, I think, and also was rather distraught that he had to share billing with such a creature. I mean, you find that as well, that in the accounts of these things, there are often actors who refuse to take the stage with learned pigs or trained dogs, and it's hard to know whether to applaud these efforts or to tell them to get with it.
I have to say, just reading the book and seeing these broadsides here, these handbills, reminded me so much of the National Enquirer of the 60s and today's Weekly World News, which still sort of promotes that kind of missing link.
I'm horribly deflated. This is probably the worst thing you've ever said to me.
Oh, I'm sure I said much worse. But I mean,
only privately.
But I mean, what I'm saying, there's a tradition of that continued. I mean,
no, you're absolutely right. There is some portion of this which deals with the lurid and the sensational. And then there are some bills in here for performers who were absolutely elegant, like Johann Nepomuk Hofzinser.
Yes, talk about him, please.
He's the man who said that playing cards were the poetry of magic. I think if I could go back in history, there's no performer I would rather see. There's no question that his card skills must have been extraordinary. I mean, the tools that he had at his disposal and his knowledge of sleight of hand is so remarkable that I just would love to have sat in the audience and watched him fry people of his day. I mean, truly elegant performer.
And as you mentioned in the piece about him, that he basically mystified everybody. That people just couldn't figure out what it was he was doing.
Oh, yeah. I think magicians as well as the lay public, yeah.
Yes.
Literally had no idea he was such a forward thinker. Yeah.
Is your feeling that he wanted to sort of maintain his mystique
It's hard to know about that. There's some people who clearly wanted to do it. There's no question that he was an employee of the Viennese government, a rather minor official. For years, people thought that he had gotten his doctorate. He was called Dr. Hofzinser, but in fact, that's not true. But he was a government official, so he wasn't even allowed to put his salon in his name. It was called the salon
name.
Wilhelmina Hofzinser, yeah. Right, to allow him to continue his work at a time, well, like any time, where magic is not the best association in the straight world. So.
But another case, too, is someone sort of elevating himself or offering that kind of background of education to offer some kind of legitimacy to what was maybe at that time certainly a derided profession.
You're absolutely right. And there were these things which were called coffee house honorifics. And you will find that magicians in many ages were being called professors and doctors and, you know, trying to use that legitimacy, the idea of showing something that might be new and educational to offset the earlier labels of witchcraft and demonology.
We'll take a break. My guest is Ricky Jay. His book is Extraordinary Exhibitions, an amazing and wonderful large-sized coffee table-sized book of broadsides and playbills from many, many years. We'll be right back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is sleight of hand artist, actor. He's in the new Gus Van Sant movie, Last Days, and author Ricky Jay. His new book is Extraordinary Exhibitions. First of all, I'm glad that we finally get a chance to get reintroduced to the learned pig of your first book here in this volume.
Well, I must say I have a special fondness for learned pigs. From the 18th century on, they've managed to attract the interest of a pretty serious group of literary luminaries. William Blake wrote about the learned pig. I mean, a long list of
people. It's shocking. When you first mentioned this in the first book, what do you think that attracts people to of the kind of lineage I've written about?
Well, I think one thinks of a pig as being absolutely intractable, as the kind of animal you can't teach anything. When in fact, pigs are actually very smart and capable of enormous stuff. But since the 18th century, the exhibition of them has drawn some interest, and sometimes it's used in derisive ways as well. Dr. Johnson, the famous Samuel Johnson, was fond of a learned pig, and when he died, there was a ditty published that said, "Though Johnson, learned bear, is gone, let us no longer mourn that loss, for lo, a learned hog has come. And wisdom grunts at Charing Cross," which shows that there were not everyone were fans of Dr. Johnson, but it is interesting. And this learned pig, the almost eponymous learned pig for years and years was called Toby, would spell out words with letters and do sums of addition and orthography. He would spell various things, and he would manage to answer questions, identify people in the audience, please go to the woman wearing the yellow scarf, and the pig would do this. And there were a whole series of learned pigs, and they've always been favorites. And over the years, I've collected probably more than a half a dozen broadsides of these animals.
Well, if I'm not saying that there's any theme here, but there's things that certainly sort of occur a number of times are this sort of the animal world being touched upon, and of course, basically amazing artists such as Basco, which you...
Oh, Bartolomeo Basco. Yeah, he's a favorite as well. He was at one point probably the most famous magician in the world, and he was considered by most people the great exponent of the cups and balls, and that is the oldest sleight of hand effect. I'm sure you've seen it, and most of your listening audience has an effect done with three cups and many balls, or a version of it done as a street hustle called the old shell game. The three shell game and the walnut shell and the peas have the same roots, and these roots, by the way, go back to ancient Egypt.
But there's a sort of, I guess, an illusion here, we should say, of his, the bullet catch. It sort of has this kind of its basis in reality to some extent, doesn't it?
Well, the idea of a magician being fired upon by actual riflemen, by marksmen with bullets which they would catch in their hands, in their teeth, or on the point of a sword actually goes back to the 16th century, and many magicians have actually died doing that. As a matter of fact, I tell a story in the new Gus Van Sant film, Last Days, about a man trying to catch a bullet in his teeth, a man named Chung Ling Su, who was really it's quite a remarkable story. It was really an American named William Ellsworth Robinson. And he died on the stage of the Wood Green Empire Theater in the full dress of a celestial, of a Chinese man trying to catch a bullet in that theater. And it's pretty wonderful. There's actually a wonderful book by my friend Jim Steinmeier that's just come out about this as well. It's called The Glorious Deception. But Basco was doing this stunt in 1827. Trying to catch a bullet as well. And the effect was that bullets would be signed, marked by initialing them with a penknife, making a mark on them, loaded into the rifles of a firing squad, and then literally fired at the magician himself, who would swoop down and catch them in his hands or, as I say, in his teeth and spit them onto a plate. So in the course of many hundreds of years of people performing this stunt, a number of people literally did lose their lives.
Well, I guess I'm looking at that because that was one of the first things that caught my eye was that actually that bill, that broadside, that poster. They sort of the physical beauty of a number of these things. I mean, you just sort of go from page to page and see the color, but also the varying types of type and the setting. Was that one of the things that attracted you to a lot of these things at first?
Absolutely. I mean, that bill in particular, which is in German, and so the type is rather beautiful, fracture typefaces. And this cut, which really has some drama to it, a blindfold man with his arms up – up near his face and a half a dozen riflemen firing him in this beautifully executed woodcut. Very, very appealing.
It's got to be at least as much for you a tactile thing as it is a visual thing.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
Just like working with cards. I mean, you like the feel of that kind of paper.
Absolutely.
That gloss, that texture, the woven texture.
Right, and I have to say that when cards started being coated with plastic, this was an enormous I was going to say problem. It's not really a problem. It's just an aesthetic issue for most people who really took pleasure in handling cards, which were pasteboard paper, layers of paper. And there are enormous differences in the quality of playing cards, always have been.
My guest is Ricky Jay. We're talking about his new book, Extraordinary Exhibitions. One of the things I'm most struck by, in fact, you introduced me to this character, this amazing figure, African-American figure, who ended up fleeing this country after a while, of course, was Henry Box Brown.
Well, Box Brown is an amazing character on many, many levels. At one point, I think it's safe to say that he was the most famous fugitive slave in America. And the story of his escape, he was literally sent in a packing crate from Virginia. He was mailed to Philadelphia and endured this incredible journey, which took 27 or 28 hours. But he had no heir in this case. There was no way that this case was to appear as if it contained a human being. It was often dropped on its side or turned upside down.
Of course, it's marked this side up.
Right, it's marked this side up, right, which did about as much good then as it would with a UPS man now. I can speak from personal experience. I just had one lose a 17th century pickpocketing print, which I bought, and I came to that and said, well, yeah, I guess we've lost this. Why don't you just get another one?
Oh, sure.
So anyway, back to H. Box Brown. He survived this, became the toast of the abolitionist community, was taught an act. He had done some singing. He was almost certainly illiterate for his life. But then it was the heyday of panorama shows, these wonderful rolling canvases, which would tell a story, the most famous of them being done by John Banvard, who did his voyage up the Mississippi. And as this panorama told the story, people said that H. Box Brown could be of great use to the community and also make a good living for himself if he came up with a panorama about African slavery. And that's what he did. And he told his own story as well as the story of slavery on this panorama. And it became quite successful, and he went to England. And I guess what happened is he began to be struck with his own success.
But didn't he go to England because he was basically forced to flee his country because of the Fugitive Slave Act?
You're absolutely right. The Fugitive Slave Act scared him and should have. I mean,
who said that was? That was basically an act that said any slave that escaped could be returned as property to where he left.
Exactly. So that is the reason that he wound up spending more than 25 years in England. So he rented a panorama show, but then he started dressing in a way that actually reminds me of a modern rapper. The descriptions of him wearing a flashy green coat and a large white hat and having rings on all of his fingers and calling himself the African Prince, and he winds up doing demonstrations of mesmerism. He has a hypnotist open for him and then actually winds up doing a magic act. And at the end of his career, he finally comes back to America, you know, well more than 20 years later. The wife and children who he's left in slavery, and the early playbills mentioning him talk about how he's trying to raise money to take them out of slavery. He's apparently completely forgotten. He's married an English woman, has a daughter with her, and the final thing we can say about him is he's in America doing a show where his daughter is escaping from a packing crate in the show. I mean, I find this a pretty poignant tale.
Oh, my God. It's about a kind of sort of a denial that still exists in a lot of African-American culture. That's why I was so fascinated by it when you first mentioned it to me, and you actually showed me that bill. And I knew the Fugitive Slave Act, but I had never heard of this figure before.
Yeah. Well, in some circles, like so many historical figures, there are people who know about him and followed his career passionately and others. Certainly in the magic world, he's not a very well-known character at all, but with my interests in magic and sleight of hand, it's a lovely combination.
My guest is Ricky Jay. We're talking about his book, Extraordinary Exhibition. So we should also mention he's in Gus Van Sant's new film, Last Days. How's that for the transition? Welcome to public radio, ladies and gentlemen. You have tended to work with directors who have a real sense, basically at the very least shape their films like writers. Is that something that attracts you to directors as kind of a state?
Well, I suppose so, although I mean, I can't think in some way of two people as different as Gus and David Mamet.
Well, or Gus and Paul Thomas Anderson, for that matter.
Yeah, well, all three are quite different in terms. I mean, in Gus's film, literally almost everything I'm saying in Last Days is improvised within a structure that Gus has come up with. So that's truly, truly as different as you can imagine from David, where every sigh is orchestrated. And I have to say, they're both comfortable for me. I think ultimately I've been really blessed by actually getting to work with such good filmmakers, and that ultimately that's what it's really all about. So if you're with somebody who you like and trust and you know his work is really good, then you're able to go in the directions that these people are suggesting.
Now, Last Days is kind of a monoclay about the last days of Kurt Cobain. And what character do you play in the film?
I actually play the Private Eye, who Courtney Love's character is never seen in this film and she's never mentioned. But I think in real life the story goes that she called the L.A. Yellow Pages on a Easter Sunday a few times, and the man who answered the phone became her private eye to supposedly investigate this case. So I play the private eye who's trying to find out what's happened in the last days of this character who's called Blake in the movie.
And given that this clearly is a lot of improvisation that exists here, how did you end up defining the character for yourself before you started to shoot?
I don't know that I did define the character before I started to shoot.
Really?
I have real trust. I mean, I'm not a method actor. I mean, I'm, if anything, a Mamedian actor, and his concept of acting is generally to trust the writer, to trust the writer's words and to go with it. But here's a case where you're trusting the director's ideas. And then, you know, as things would go, you know, we'd say, well, that sounds interesting. Gus would say, try to, you know, tell a story about that. Or, you know, I would pick up an object as we were walking through a room and he would say, well, that's interesting. Tell a story about that. And so I really didn't come to it with much in the way of preconceived notions. And I even had a friend who was quite close to the real detective and made a conscious decision not to speak to him and not to know too much about the real case, that it just made sense to me to approach it as Gus's vision rather than with any preconceived notion.
What was your first meeting with him like, if you remember it?
Yeah, we met in a hotel in downtown New York here. I don't like to read. I mean, I feel incapable of it. I think it's all my years of doing sleight of hand that when you're asked to read for a film, you know, everything I do in my life is completely practiced and rehearsed before anyone sees it. And it seems to me when you go in and are handed pages and asked to read them that it's – I've never gotten over the feeling that I'm reading the pages with my pants at my ankles. It's not a comfortable feeling for me. So on the other hand, I'm happy to speak to a director and see, you know, what they have to say about it and what I have to say about it. And so we just had a friendly chat. I mean, he's the most laid-back, easiest fellow to be around. And I have to say that meeting was completely like the experience of doing the film with him. I mean, it just was. There was almost no difference in the way he was chatting with me at breakfast than the way he was directing me in this film.
My guest is Ricky Jay. His new film is Gus Van Sant's Last Days, and this book, this amazing book, is called Extraordinary Exhibitions. Ricky, thanks so much for doing the show.
My pleasure, kid.
Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Lashik Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holgers produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.